Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. These days, the final frontier may be closer than you think. It's only about 100 miles up. 40 years ago, space exploration meant a dose of the right stuff and dreams of a ride to the stars. Today, the most coveted realm of space isn't much more than a slim envelope around the home planet, that skinny halo called near-Earth orbit. As near as that focus might be, the implications for already crowded space real estate are far-reaching. While NASA sends up its near-Earth workhorse, the space shuttle, other countries have different designs on space. The Europeans want to develop their own global positioning system. The Chinese are planning to build a manned space station of their own and take a walk on the moon to boot. And the Russians are throwing a space fire sale, selling seats to space tourists at $100,000 a go. The military wants to put great guns and eagle eyes in near space that can look down and target any point anywhere on Earth. Listeners, what do you think space should be used for? Do you miss the days of American moon landings and dreams of Mars and beyond? Did you ever think the new global space race would be so close to home? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us in the studio is Andy Chaikin. He's science journalist who specializes in space and author of the book, A Man on the Moon. Welcome, Andrew Chaikin.
Thank you, Tom. It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you. Andy Chaikin, we are hearing new little bits coming out almost every day lately. The Chinese have just brought a spacecraft down, saying they're sending men up next. They want to be on the moon in 2005. Their own space station. Europeans talking about geosynchronous satellites to give more geopositioning. I guess that's been an American domain until now. Right. Tonga even is talking about sending somebody up in space. The Russians, I see just today, have now got a mock-up of their Disney tourist space shuttle that they're coming out with soon. And I see in the paper today, Steven Tyler, the singer for Aerosmith, says he wants to go to space. It all seems to be about this near-Earth orbit where so much is going on. What's the buzz? What's driving all this?
There is a lot going on. In fact, Tom, there is so much going on that even for somebody in my position who covers this stuff, it's really hard to keep track of it all. I mean, I found myself kind of staring at, you know, a million web printouts before I came over here, just trying to get up to date because it is so active. And it's happening in a lot of different areas. You mentioned several. Let's just take China, for example. Mm-hmm. The big news there is that China just brought back a prototype of their new spaceship called Shenzhou, which is derived from a Russian design, the workhorse Russian space taxi called Soyuz.
We saw the picture of it plunked down in the Mongolian desert, just like the Russian landings. Not in the ocean like NASA would
have it,
but boing, right there on Earth.
Well, because like Russia, China has a lot of land and would rather bring their capsules down on land than in the water, whereas we always had a lot of water to deal with, so it was easier for us to do water landing. It's not a very inspiring-looking craft, the Chinese want to
looks
put
like a gumdrop.
It does, exactly, just like the Soyuz does. And but it will probably carry the first Chinese citizen to be launched by China into space sometime next year or the year after. And this will make China only the third country in the history of space exploration capable of putting a human in space.
Andy, talk about the premise. I guess it may never have been NASA's plan, but for a lot of Americans, space and space exploration brought to mind going way, way out there, going to the ends of the solar system, going to different planets. Now the activity seems to be in space, but very Earth-focused, all about military applications and driving new technology and radio in our cars that will follow us everywhere we go, and our mobile phones and everything else. It all seems to be turned around back on Earth.
I wouldn't say it that way. I would say there's always been both. Even as we were first taking our steps into space, in fact, if you go back to the late 1950s, when the Russians beat us into space by launching Sputnik, we were able to get our first satellite up in 1958, and And right after that, you saw the Russians and the Americans firing probes at the moon. And by the early 1960s, both countries were sending probes to the planets. It's been a gradual growth, but the activity in Earth orbit, the difference there is that there is a commercial aspect that going to the planets does not have. The exploration of the solar system is still a scientific bonanza, but in Earth orbit is where you have the money makers, communication satellites.
Give us a sense of that range of applications.
Well, communication satellites, which have been in existence since 1960, have flourished and blossomed and are the biggest growth industry in space. And they're still growing, and the band of satellites that circles the Earth and is in a 24-hour orbit that's called geosynchronous orbit is so crowded that you have to kind of wait in line to get a slot up there. In addition to communication satellites...
And let me ask, while we're on that, what does crowded mean in space? How close do satellites have to be before it starts to feel crowded?
Well, you got me. I can't give you an actual number, but it's not so close that if you were sitting on one satellite, you'd see the other one right next to you.
They're not wing-to-wing up there.
They're not wing-to-wing, but they're close enough so that, you know, they don't want to have any kind of error in the positioning so that one might...
Interference, et cetera.
Interfere, exactly. So, you know, communication satellites. In addition, there is this global positioning system, which is satellites in a much lower orbit, only a few hundred miles up, which circle the Earth rather quickly, once every 90 minutes. But what they've done is they've put a constellation of these satellites up there. And just like a ship on the sea that can use several transmitting stations on the shore to find out its position by triangulating, so we can use these little GPS receivers. You can go to any of the outdoor shops and buy them and carry it with you, and you know exactly where you are on the surface of the Earth. And, of course, if you're in the military, you have access to even finer GPS data. And now, as you mentioned, this has been a domain of the United States for the last many years, but now the Europeans are poised to put up their own GPS system, and that has caused quite a bit of anxiety on the U.S. because in time of war, the Pentagon wants to be able to jam all of the different GPS satellites so that, you know, the enemy doesn't have access to that data.
Well, what about that? We have the sense after NASA went to the moon, and ultimately when the Soviet Union fell apart, that space was the domain of the United States. How vigorously, how effectively, successfully are other countries now probing into space and more than probing?
What happened after the moon, and of course, just to frame the moon race, we didn't go to the moon for the sake of exploration or for science, even though those were magnificent payoffs. We went to the moon to beat the Russians. And once we beat the Russians, that pretty much took the wind out of the sails of the planners at NASA who wanted to have this onward and upward visionary space program.
But for a brief moment, all politics were lunar.
Exactly. And beyond, you know. I mean, there was talk of sending people to Mars in the 1980s, but by the 1980s, and all that went out the window when the Nixon administration said, we're, you know, fighting a war in Vietnam, we've got environmental concerns, we've got inflation, we don't have money to send people to Mars. But at that time, the Russians, who had always been vigorous in Earth orbit, continued with activities, space stations in Earth orbit, that sort of thing. The Russians have continued in a very kind of hare and tortoise kind of way. They've been the tortoise and have always used throwaway rockets while we've strived to get the cutting edge technology with our reusable space shuttle. And they have racked up, you know, months and years of human time in Earth orbit. Now, of course, we're poised to see the Chinese begin their activities in Earth orbit. And the Europeans, all along, since the 1970s, there are now 15 member nations in the European Space Agency. Mm-hmm. And they have activities that range from commercial to scientific research on of the Earth, you know, satellites that look down on the Earth and track environmental changes. In fact, they just sent up a $2 billion satellite, which is going to map climate changes and so forth on the Earth. It's called Envisat, and it was launched last month.
Andy, I want to ask, is there room for everybody in this near-Earth orbit? Is there room for all the nations and all the commercial undertakings and all the ambitions for this orbit? Are people staking claims? Can you have spatial claims in space? This is my satellite zone. Get your satellite out of here. Or who's adjudicating? Are we bumping heads and shoulders up there?
Well, I think the only place place you really run into a real estate problem is in that geosynchronous orbit that we talked about. Once you get down into the lower orbits, as long as you are very careful about how you track your satellites and make sure it doesn't hit anything else, there really isn't a question of real estate. And I think that the salient question is who is going to use space to make a profit at this point, because that is really the driving force in expanding space activities. There's only so much that the governments of the world will pay for in space. And the big question that we've had ever since Stanley Kubrick's film, 2001, with the giant space station and the hotels, remember that? The hotel on the space station? We don't know what is going to be the gold rush in Earth orbit. For years, NASA's been saying, just let us build a space station, and we will find things to do in weightlessness that will just, you know, knock
your
socks off. Right. And that stuff has yet to really materialize. There's a lot of interest in space tourism, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But it's not clear that even that is going to drive a big commercial push into space.
And yet there are now many private companies who are looking to space to pursue their business. Is that mostly about just getting the rockets up there? I mean, launching capsules, whatever it is, into space? Is it about transport, in other words? Or are they what are they doing? Well, it's all about getting satellites up still?
Well, there will always be a market for communication satellites. And as we're seeing, the GPS stuff is huge. In fact, just to tell you, you know, we mentioned knowing where you are on the Earth, and that's, of course, good for search and rescue. It's good for military applications. But they're also using it in the trucking industry, and they're using it to measure traffic patterns and counting cars. They're even using GPS to track migrations of whales. So that's another growth area. You know, the big questions are, is there anything that's intrinsically valuable about being in space? Can we manufacture something in space that would be so valuable that it's worth spending all the money you need to spend to get up there and bring it back? Space tourism, you know, the California businessman who went up there last year to the ISS on the Russian rocket, he paid $20 million. Now, at $20 million a pop, is that a growth industry? I'm not sure it is. We've got everybody from Lance Bass of NSYNC to
waiting in line
to a sort of a soccer mom, actually a friend of mine, Lori Garver in Virginia, who's a longtime space advocate, duking it out for one of the seats to the space station next fall. But, you know, so far this has just become kind of a flash in the pan kind of thing. The big problem, Tom, is how to get into low Earth orbit cheaply. And that is still as hard to do now. It still costs $10,000 a pound to put something in Earth orbit, just like it did 20, 30 years ago.
And yet, I can't help but be struck by the way that space does seem so Earth-oriented now, and not nearly as oriented toward the distant stars, the distant, at least what we hear about, the drumbeat of news stories. It's all about this envelope, as though space is simply another vantage point on whatever's going on Earth, whether it's military or communication or ultimately, you know, the next Disney World. It's the envelope just above the clouds, just above the stratosphere, where all the action seems to be.
Well, I'm going to take a different point of view, because my area of interest is space exploration, and I am very conscious of the ways in which we're continuing to have really exciting stuff in exploring the planets. And then, of course, there's the Hubble, which is in low Earth orbit. It is in low Earth orbit.
But it's all about looking out.
It's looking out, and it's seeing back in time almost to the beginning of the universe. And that's not, I mean, there are other satellites up there that are looking at the universe differently than Hubble. It's an extraordinary time for space-based astronomy, too.
We've got so much to talk about with space tonight.
It's hard to narrow it all down.
Give us a sense of NASA right now. Its health, its staffing, is it big as ever, or is it shrunk? We've just got a minute. Maybe we'll come back to it. But get us started on NASA.
I'll try and encapsulate it. NASA's really kind of in a tough spot, mostly because they have sunk so much money into the International Space Station, which is not yet complete. The estimated cost is now $30 billion, which is well above a congressional budget cap of $25 billion. And the agency has been told, you cannot finish that station until we make a review. And that will make the international partners very, very mad. We can talk more about it, but they're in trouble.
NASA's in trouble with the space station. When's it due to be completed?
Well, the original date, well, the date that everybody has been saying is 2006. But the question is, if
that would be 2006. That would be 4 years from now.
4 years from now. And the big question is, will they be able to complete it to the point where they can have six or seven people aboard? Right now, they only have three people. And you need most of the time for three people to just maintain the station, never mind do all this great scientific work.
Will the Chinese have a man on the moon before the space station's complete?
No.
Okay. We'll
that I feel confident about.
We're talking with Andy Chaiken, science journalist and writer on space. We're talking about the new space race, a turf war in near-Earth orbit. If this planet isn't big enough for all of us, will space help or just extend Earth's turf wars? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about space tonight, about near-Earth orbit and beyond. Do you care if the satellite that tracks your cell phone is French or American? And who owns space? Anyone? No one? Now? Ever? Should space be a winner-take-all arena? How do you see it shaking out? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest tonight is Andy Chaiken. He's a science journalist who specializes in writing about space. Andy Chaiken, we were talking before about how private companies have got their eye on space. Everybody's looking for the profit is here. Governments have become a little bit nudgy, the United States government in any case, about getting up there if they can't see a profit. Do you see governments continuing to be the primary mover in space activity, or are we reaching a point where the private sector takes the lead role?
I think for the foreseeable future, it is still going to be a governmental activity. There's some talk about maybe down the line trying to privatize the space station, assuming it gets completed. But again, you have to ask the question, what would a company pay all the money that it takes to operate and put people up there? What would be the lure? We don't know what that lure is yet.
So far, communications is the big one.
Right, and you don't need to put people up there to do that. Now, communication satellites are a private industry kind of a thing, and so is GPS. And by the way, there is an industry of high-resolution photography of the Earth by these satellites that are in low-Earth orbit that are built and operated by private companies. There are two companies, for example, in Colorado. One is called Space Imaging, and the other is called Digital Globe. They're both doing very, very well. And the funny thing is that these images are so good. I mean, for example, the satellite that was just launched last month called QuickBird is so good that it can spot the lines on a tennis court. It took a picture of a golf course and saw shadows of a foursome playing golf.
Okay.
Now, these things...
So smile, you're on space camera.
Yeah, and it's got a lot of applications for example, foreign countries to tell how are their cities growing and changing. They can do that with satellite imagery better than they can on the ground.
We've seen recently the example of how the Antarctic ice shelf was tracked by satellite photo.
That's right, and that's another great usage of these things to track environmental changes. But the military is also very interested in these satellites. In fact, the DOD went in and bought up. They exercise a sort of a shutter control. When we started the offensive in Afghanistan, The war in Afghanistan, the DOD went in and bought up all of the rights to the imagery of Afghanistan so that they couldn't be had by private individuals.
Only the Pentagon would be looking on. Andy Chaiken, stand by. We're joined now by Bruce Sterling. He's author of many columns in Science and Wired magazines. His article, Astrocop, about the future of missile defense, is available in the April issue of Wired magazine. His latest book is called Zeitgeist. Good evening and welcome, Bruce Sterling.
Hi, how are you?
Well, great, thanks. Bruce, you got us all revved up with your Wired article on the U.S. as the big cop in space. We've been talking about commercial interest in space, about general governmental interest in space. You say that the United States military is terrifically fired up about what's going on and what it can do from space.
Yeah, I think that's very much the case. If you read statements coming out of the Defense Department lately, they're very enthusiastic about it because this really is the sort of the American version of asymmetric warfare. Space war is what we've got that opponents just don't.
You said that Reagan's Star Wars is as dead as Milli Vanilli, but there's a George W. Star Wars, which is much more applicable, practical, and being put into play right now.
Yeah, that would be theater missile defense. I think there's a definite groundswell of interest in this. In the idea of a missile suppression system.
That is to shoot down missiles before they get anywhere on Earth.
Yeah, but small numbers of them. Mm-hmm. That's the key. I mean, nobody's under the illusion that they could stop a full-scale ICBM launch by a superpower. Well, okay, some people are still under that illusion. But, you know, practically speaking, you're a lot better off trying to cultivate the ability to suppress missile launches from the likes of North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Sterling, you've described Donald Rumsfeld as a super enthusiast of the military in space. Give us a sense of the outlook, the philosophy, the view of the military universe that's driving Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, he did three different reviews all along this line. They're known as Rumsfeld 1, Rumsfeld 2, and Rumsfeld 3. One is about the ballistic missile threat to the United States. And I think that's sort of the most interesting and the most influential of the bunch, because this was before Rumsfeld took power again, and he was basically on a blue ribbon panel that he chaired, and he was able to get his fellow panelists to think outside the box, to put away the old Cold War ideas of nations launching missiles against other nations, and to consider what people can do with just, say, the likes of an Iraqi silkworm missile,
mm-hmm.
which is portable and concealable. It could be hidden in lumber trucks. It could be hidden in tramp freighters, but still, capped with some warhead. With some weapon of mass destruction, however crude.
You've said that Rumsfeld has gone from that insight to go on to believe that the U.S. needs to control and dominate space, no matter what anybody else thinks about it, and that the end result there is a strategy you described as death from above, but in military jargon, denying sanctuary with persistent surveillance tracking, rapid engagement, high-volume precision strikes at all times, all weathers, all terrain. It sounds like turning the space into the all-on, all-the-time military platform.
I think it works. I mean, it's not a science fictional notion. It's been proven repeatedly. It worked quite well in the Gulf War. It worked very well in Serbia. And it was, really baffling to the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Andy Chaikin, do you see military applications in space overwhelming other applications because they can be used right now and there's plenty of conflict going on?
I hope not. I mean, there will always be a place for military applications in space, as Bruce is saying, but we've always had a separation of the civilian programs and the military programs, and I hope it continues to stay that way. Space has the potential to drive the growth of our culture, and I that may sound far-fetched, but I really believe that in terms of technology, in terms of inspiration that it gives, in terms of new knowledge, and we cannot afford to just spend our space dollars on military applications.
Do you have a sense right now of the relative weight of military versus civilian space activity in the U.S.? Which one is getting more money? Which one is more active?
I mean, I don't have, Bruce probably knows the numbers better than I do, and for some reason I have trouble storing those kinds of things, but military's always gotten more money than civilian. I think even at the height of the Apollo program, the DOD was probably getting more all combined than NASA.
And Bruce Sterling, you've written that the U.S. has set its sights on being AstroCop and that it's really already won the contest, that it dominates. At least that's the headline that Wired put on it. Is that your view?
Yeah, I think that's very much the case.
Is that now and forever, or is that a position that's open to challenge?
It is a position open to challenge. It's not open to easy challenge because the U.S. has just tremendous advantages here. I mean, this is the one military aspect that the U.S. really is best at. They've got more practice at it. They have better backing at it. They've, worked at it years and years, decades now. I mean, it's been 50 years since Wernher von Braun first wrote his popular science articles in Collier's magazine, explaining to the U.S. population that we were going to have a space race and that we were going to go out and really do this. And aviation is just, almost since the birth of aviation at the Wright brothers, this has been a tremendous American specialty. We have spent huge sums on this. And yes, there are efforts to do otherwise. I mean, the Chinese are having a baby space race.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the taikonaut thing is for real. It's really fascinating. But I don't think they intend to go head-to-head with the U.S. because they can't. I think they intend to go head-to-head with India, actually.
Well, Andy Chaikin, you laugh, but there's many levels, I suppose, of interaction with space.
No, that's absolutely true. And I think the Chinese have discovered what the U.S. and the Russians have known for years, which is that having a space program is kind of a mark of international status.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of a prestige thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's as much behind the Chinese space program as anything. But I want to ask Bruce, I want to bring up a subject of satellites attacking other satellites. Bruce, what can you say about the level of energy and funding that's being put into those sorts of things, you know, anti-satellite space-based systems?
Zapping each other in space.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's mostly on the drawing board. When I wrote my article, I went down to the Beltway and talked to every Space War Beltway bandit I could find. And I came up with 13 different schemes by which people can challenge these applications in space. And, you know, build your own would be number one, of course, but that's what the Russians tried, and that didn't work. I think that if you were to ask Donald Rumsfeld what his major worry is, he would worry most about decapitating the U.S. government by some kind of truck bomb within Washington.
And that's very much terrestrial, Bruce Sterling.
Yeah, it's very much terrestrial. You can also attack the tracking stations. You can attack the analysts. You can attack, you can try to attack Cheyenne Mountain. But good luck working your way through that granite. It makes Tora Bora look like a children's place.
But your point there is that there's a limit to the defense that can be provided by equipment in space?
It makes very little sense to go out there and start armoring, our spacecraft for a good old-fashioned Star Wars-style wingtip-to-wingtip fighter battle.
I see that the vulnerability is so much greater on Earth.
Practical,
mm-hmm.
But you can do certain things like explode a nuclear warhead in low Earth orbit and do what they call electromagnetic pulse. It sends out a blast of radiation and magnetic energy, which can strip unshielded computer chips and possibly blind satellites.
Mm. Bruce Sterling, Andrew Chaikin, stand by. I want to bring our callers in here. David is on the line. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Good to have you.
This is about time we had this show.
Let's celebrate space.
Yeah, well, it makes sense. The two observations. The first is that, a long, long time ago, Robert Heinlein observed that there is no that we live at the bottom of a gravity well, and there is no conceivable way to stop weapons from space coming down to Earth if we ever decide to launch them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just fact. So there's two approaches you can take to that, and the approach we've taken for the last 40 years is to try and keep weapons out of space.
You're saying what
you
comes up must come down and may end up willy-nilly falling on our own heads.
Well, one of my favorite stories was when he put a lunar colony that threw rocks at us, and everybody laughed at them until the rocks hit. And you do the calculation, a rock thrown from the moon is going to be able to destroy cities. I mean, you know, it's gravity is energy, and so even without fancy particle beam weapons, you can do a lot of damage from space, and we've known that for a long time. We've tried to keep weapons out of space. That was one way of approaching that problem, and it looks like we're now trying the other approach, which is to militarize space.
David, what most catches your attention about space
these
days?
I'm just drawn by the limitless potential, and I hope the military doesn't own it, because the military, when they own things, doesn't tend to allow other things to happen around them, and there's a lot of really cool stuff we could do with space.
What would you like to be doing?
Yeah,
what would you like to have the United States doing?
I would like to see what art we could create in space. I want to see the dance. I want to see the music. I want to see the plays. I want to see what human creativity could do with space.
The Northern Lights aren't enough for you.
No. I want to see the star dance. I'll listen to comments from the rest of them. You've got a great panel there. Keep up the good work.
Great, David, thanks for calling. Andrew Chaikin, art in space? Is that next on the horizon? That's a pretty, at $10,000 a pound, it better be chalk.
I don't know if it's next on the horizon, but I hope it happens before I'm too old to see it. I think the potential of space to inspire us and to impact our lives and enrich our lives we just scratched the surface. I mean, you know, when you have a space program that is done at such great cost and can only be done by governments, But there is, for example, a module that a private company would like to build for the International Space Station called the Enterprise Module, which would be devoted purely to commercial activities. There is some hope that maybe this would solve the budget problems for the space station by providing extra space and an extra Soyuz for crew return capability. But conceivably, if people could ante up that $20 million a seat, you could see artists going up. You could see sculptors experimenting in zero gravity. You could see musicians and writers all taking advantage of this mountaintop experience, the experience of getting beyond the bounds of human existence, the environment in which our species evolved, and looking down on our planet as a planet.
We can feel the appetite among people to do that even now. They're lining up for these trips at $100,000 a pop, still a long way off if they ever actually come.
That's a big if.
Yeah. Henry's on the line. Welcome, Henry. You're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
I have a very brief question.
Mm-hmm.
In 1969, when we landed on the moon, we planted an American flag. Do we own that real estate?
So you wonder if this is like planting a flag for the King of Spain? Bruce Sterling, how about it? Do we know if the flag's still standing? And does that mean anything about property rights in space?
Well, there are any number of international, high-level international agreements about property rights in space and so forth. In fact, one of the, I think there's a treaty dating back to, I believe, the early 1960s, in which people agreed to permit overflights of their continental masses, their airspace, under the condition that space would not be militarized. So if you put actual, space lasers, something directly aggressive up there, you will be abrogating this solemn treaty. Which, conceivably could have a lot of rather grim repercussions. I don't think the U.S. is particularly anxious to put any weapons into space per se, because as has been pointed out several times, they cost $10,000 a pound.
Mm-hmm.
You really want space to be the back office. You want it to coordinate your daisy cutters, your B-52s, your cruise missiles, your special forces.
On the ground, but not actually have cannon
killer
up there.
I mean, and to have the ability to leverage that from space is more deadly than some kind of nuclear powered gizmo up there trying to wreak havoc from low Earth orbit.
And Andy, to Henry's question, what are property rights on the moon all about? Has it been divvied up, or is it eternally supposed to be everyone's?
Well, the Peaceful Uses of Space Treaty that Bruce mentioned was signed in 1967 specifies that no nation can claim the moon. And in fact, the flags that were left at the six places where human beings landed on the moon were done simply as a gesture of national pride rather than ownership. By the way, the flag at Apollo 11 did fall down when they lifted off the moon. So, no, there is no such thing as ownership of the moon, no matter. And for that matter, those companies that try and sell you a star don't have any legal basis for that either. But, no, it's beyond ownership by international agreement.
So it's everybody's.
Yeah.
Well,
while we're talking about threats from space, and I know we'll get to this, there is a bigger threat waiting out there in the form of Earth-crossing asteroids that could provide an impetus for the entire space program.
You're saying to be able to go up and blow them up, there's some that could hit the Earth and we need to knock them off course?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Larry Niven, the science fiction writer, pointed out that the dinosaurs became extinct because they didn't have a space program.
There's a non-commercial application that you could probably rally some people behind. Knocking asteroids off course. We're talking about space tonight, about near-Earth orbit and beyond. Does it still capture your imagination? Are you ready to go? Are you itching to be one of the first space tourists? Do you still see a free range in the night sky? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about space tonight, about a new space race in near-Earth orbit and the prospects for exploration in distant space. What do you think? Do you still want to see the U.S. government pouring dollars into the final frontier? Or is it time to hand the race over to private enterprise? And more broadly, do you still see a free range in that beautiful night sky? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Tom is on the line. Welcome, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I want to thank you for having this great discussion tonight, and thanks for your guests for doing a good job so far.
Glad to do it.
Based on something you just said, you know, I don't want NASA to be going and spending tons of dollars to send one person to Mars or to maintain a space station. I think NASA should be doing what it was originally founded to do, which is to do the sort of cutting-edge research that's sort of a little far out that will enable us to bring down that cost of getting to space. I mean, Andrew was talking about, you know, no one really knows besides telecom satellites what you can do in space to make money, but the reason that you can't make money is because it costs so much to get there.
Mm-hmm.
If you can bring that cost down, everything changes. The whole game just changes if you can bring that cost down.
Any advice, Tom, on how we might pull that off?
There's all sorts of different technologies out there. No one can really say what they are, but, you know, I think it's important that NASA does the research to help industry. Right now, NASA, for the last decade or two, NASA keeps coming up with a program or a different program to do their they came up with their idea of what the final rocket, the final transportation system is going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of like trying to pick the winner before you really know what's going to happen. Instead, they should be focusing on the sort of component technologies, you know, sort of maybe scramjet technologies, maybe reusable rockets, maybe something that's, you know, a little more advanced than that.
Scramjet. Now you've got our attention. Tom, thanks for calling. Let me put it first to Andy Chaikin. You said this is the number one hurdle to greater exploitation of space or travel in space. What's on the drawing board? Is there a cheaper way? Is there a lower toll that we could arrange?
So far, there's nothing that has really come to cutting metal that promises to lower that cost. In fact, NASA had a kind of abortive attempt at building a next-generation shuttle that was called the X-33. It was kind of a joint venture with Lockheed Martin. And they abandoned the project before they could even test fly it. However, if NASA were not spending so much money on the space station, it's entirely possible that they could have a very productive effort in trying to refine space technology. What he mentioned about scramjets, in other words, you'd have a vehicle that would use the Earth's atmosphere to provide propulsion as far as it could go.
Kind of a slingshot somehow.
Well, get it up high in the atmosphere, mm-hmm. get it going fast, and then launch something from the back of this air-powered vehicle that would go into space. But, you know, the funding situation is so dire. The space station is just like a great big money pit.
And is it still the future, or are we funding visions of the past there?
Well, it's not clear. I mean, that's why I say NASA's in trouble. They may be able to get out of this trouble. But, you know, even when the budget situation did not look so dire, I had one person at NASA say to me, "Listen, after we get this thing finished, I figure we've got about 5 years to cure cancer, you know, to prove the value of this space station that we've been touting for all these years." It's not clear. There's a scientific community that's very upset about the fact that the space station has eaten up so much of the money. On the other hand, it is the unknown. We won't know until we try.
Until we've got that platform.
But I want to say one other thing, Tom, very quickly, which is that NASA is an executive agency, and it has to get its orders from the top. If people are upset that NASA's not doing the right thing, they need to make their voices heard, because NASA can only take orders from the executive branch.
But it's hard to see right now how we can cough that space station out. I mean, basically got to go ahead with that.
That's the big hurdle.
Kevin is on the line. Welcome, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks.
This is such a great topic, and I got in a little late, so I'm afraid I don't know the panelist's name. But I guess my question is that I heard a couple of years ago, it might not even have been that long ago, that there was a move afoot by some commercial enterprises to put actually satellites in space that would beam advertising, or that would be bright enough to show, to put advertising on.
So we'll see Coca-Cola written in the night sky.
It's something along those lines, yes. And I wondered about the viability of that, if that was really something that we needed to concern ourselves with, because, I can't imagine a worse endeavor or a worse thing to do to our night sky than to put advertising in it.
Let's put it to our guests. And, Kevin, thanks for your call. Bruce Sterling, you first. Is the military ready to write surrender now up there?
I don't think so, but it's an open scandal how overlit cities are. Astronomers are very fussy about the light that we spill on ourselves on the ground already, which is blocking off the night sky. You wouldn't be able to see the night sky. You wouldn't be able to see Pepsi-Cola ads for the light pollution.
Even if they were up there. Andy Chaikin, is there anything still alive on this front? Do people still want to scrawl something and do skywriting in low Earth orbit?
Not that I'm aware of. I think most of the advertising dollars in space are going towards having cosmonauts film Coke commercials and so forth. They used to do that aboard Mir, or commercials for an Israeli milk company, I remember. But that idea of writing something in the sky, I think the light pollution advocates alone would probably put them off.
Dave is on the line. Welcome, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say I've been thinking about this mostly in terms of the more deep space exploration side of this.
Okay.
I think, and the low Earth orbit stuff, I think you're going to find probably – you're always going to find kind of gimmick opportunities and, you know, private sector opportunities. But in the, when it comes to deep space orbit – I mean deep space exploration.
Travel. Mm-hmm.
I think that there you kind of have to look at it in terms of any time that somebody wants to spend large amounts of money on a speculative kind of venture, you get basically the three Fs. It's either because of fear, because of faith, or because of you have facts. And if you look at the 1960s, we went into space because a lot of it was because of fear, you know, with the Soviets.
Right.
Right now we don't have facts about what the payoff is going to be, so really it comes down to basically faith. And that's why it's really a very ideological issue. And I think there's kind of...
And are you saying faith that exploration is worthwhile in its own terms?
Faith that there'll be a payoff. And you can't see the fact that is you don't have the facts. You have to basically take
it. But you're going anyway.
Yeah. And I think that are you going to be the one... Think about this in a very practical sense. Would you be the kind of person who'd stand there at a party and try and say, it's not worth going into space because you know you're gonna sound like the Luddite. You're probably not even gonna think it's right.
Right, Dave. We've got it, and our time is running down. Bruce Sterling, let me put that first to you. The military seems to have a pretty deep faith in space. It's not coming back.
Well, I think one of the reasons for that is that the military doesn't do astronauts. They're not putting human flesh into space.
Mm-hmm.
They're not really waving flags up there. And I think there's a golden opportunity to come up with new launch methods for very small, very rugged satellites.
Mm. And Andy Chaikin,
no human beings.
No human beings by the military. Andy Chaikin, our time's really running down. But how about the civilian side here? Where does the faith stand that space and even deep space is worth exploring?
It comes up against everything in our culture that is obsessed with the near term. Space is about the long term. It's about the long term survival of the human species. It's about knowing where we are and where we came from. It's about understanding the origin of the Earth and the planets. And it's about ultimately immortality for the human species, because we will go into space ultimately to colonize other planets and preserve the species.
Well, there's something to build a ship for, and we'll keep that in the back of our minds as we think about that next NASA budget. Andy Chaikin, thanks so much for coming on tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Andy Chaikin is a science journalist, specializes in writing about space. He's authored most recently of A Man on the Moon. And Bruce Sterling, thank you for being with us tonight.
I enjoyed that.
Bruce Sterling's article, AstroCop, is on the cover of the April issue of Wired magazine. His latest book is called Zeitgeist. Check out the latest news from around the world at onpointradio.org. Up next, one college student's love affair with space. When Samit Chakrabarty was 5 years old, he saw Saturn through a telescope and saw a potential future for him in space. As he grew older, he read all about the heroes and events of the space race of the 50s and 60s. He's now a senior at MIT, and in this diary, he says that great adventures lie ahead for those who were born after Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon. For full disclosure, he is the brother of a producer here at On Point, but he also happens to be a former president of Students for the Exploration and Development of Space and is still the president of the MIT chapter of that organization.
"Don't run, you might fall," my dad shouted out after me in the pitch black darkness. But I ran anyway. Nothing was going to keep me from those telescopes. I was 5 years old on that night. The local astronomy club had set up a public observation session out at a horse barn in the countryside. I'd never looked through a telescope before, so I had to run. Maybe I should have listened to my dad. I fell into a grassy ditch, skinning my knee and my enthusiasm. Unable to walk on my own, my dad had to carry me over to the telescopes. But as soon as I peered through the telescope's eyepiece, I forgot my pain. There was the image of Saturn, the jewel of the sky, burning into my eye. At first, I was confused. When I looked up at the sky with my naked eye, all I could see was a shimmering point of light. Yet through the telescope, I saw a world crowned by a majestic set of golden rings. For the first time, I realized that all those twinkling stars in the sky were more than just lights. They were entire worlds. The Earth was just one of a countless number of them. These worlds were so far away that no one had ever set foot on them. They were so big that no one could fully fathom them. And this mystery entranced me. I became hooked on space. I dreamed of a Star Trek future where people would race from star system to star system, exploring strange new worlds. I watched 2001, A Space Odyssey, hoping that one day I too would vacation on board an orbiting Hilton hotel. But for my generation, this was just a fantasy. So I read all about real spaceflight and grew to idolize the astronauts, Yuri Gagarin heroically strapping a rocket to his back to become the first man in space, John Glenn bravely doing the same soon afterwards. And who can forget Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin taking giant leaps for mankind across the lunar sea of tranquility? But for my generation, all of this was simply history. We were confined to learning about these inspirational events through books at the library and TV specials on the Discovery Channel. Many space enthusiasts my age have grown demoralized and feel betrayed. After all, nothing exciting has happened in space in 30 years. We see space exploration as the previous generation's great adventure. Will we ever have our own? We've stalled, aimlessly circling around in Earth orbit. The space shuttle is little more than a government jobs program. It is hardly a cheaper ticket to space than Alan Shepard's 1961 Mercury spacecraft. And what about the moon? If we wanted to return to the lunar surface this year, we could not. We no longer have rockets powerful enough to get us there. And what about sending humans to Mars? This item has disappeared from NASA's agenda. Where is the Star Trek future we've always expected? I almost fell into this trap, too. But then, on July 4th, 1997, a robot changed my life. On that day, an unmanned NASA spacecraft called Pathfinder bounced on airbags to a landing on Mars. Hours later, Pathfinder deployed Sojourner, the first robotic rover to ever roam another planet. Over the next 3 weeks, the six-wheeled, microwave-sized rover captivated a billion people as it inspected the rusty rocks of a bleak, desolate Martian floodplain. I, too, was transfixed by the images of Sojourner. Sojourner was a piece of us. It represented an extension of humanity dispatched to explore a world 300 million miles away. This is the future of spaceflight. This will be my generation's legacy. We may not send humans to the outer planets or build space hotels in the sky, but we will build intelligent machines that will roam the universe as our proxies of silicon and steel. Like children at college, they will phone home from time to time and tell us about the exciting discoveries they have made. Or, like well-traveled friends sharing their photo albums, they will show us pictures that reveal the universe in unprecedented detail. The space adventures that lay ahead for my generation are no less exciting than the ones had by the previous. In my lifetime, robotic spacecraft will have returned Martian rocks back to the Earth. Automated factories in Earth orbit will exploit the zero-gravity environment to assemble novel pharmaceuticals that will cure otherwise incurable diseases. And we will deploy teams of space telescopes that will work together to act as one giant telescope, searching for Earth-like planets. They may even peer into the atmospheres of those planets and discover that industrial pollutants are present in the air, a telltale marker of intelligent life. I can't wait to look through that telescope.
Sameed Chakrabarty lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Listeners, we want to hear your story on our program. Diaries like these begin with an email or a letter from you. They start out as a short essay of about 750 words. Give us your personal take on our world today. How is the conflict in Israel, the war on terror, the economy, even the change of seasons affecting your life? Send in your ideas to onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.